You're listening to The Healthy Sensitive. Welcome to The Healthy Sensitive, a podcast for highly sensitive leaders, managers, entrepreneurs, or maybe aspiring leaders, managers, entrepreneurs who are trying to figure out how to dare greatly while also keeping their health, their vitality, if at all possible, their sanity intact. I'm Leah Burkhart, health educator, burnout coach, content creator, and newly launched solopreneur, and also your hostess. In today's episode, I'm talking about something that's really close to home. I'm talking about risk. And to kind of give a little background about this, I mean, the risk I'll be talking about as it relates to myself is my more recent risk that I'm taking. I've alluded to it already, my launch as a sort of freelance individual. But there's some backstory to it. So as a kid, the primary adults in my life were people that I honestly felt, you know, I think there's a difference between a person who follows their intuition, sort of their inner knowing, their sense of moral compass, that quiet voice inside of all of us that's gently guiding us toward our dharma, our true self, versus impulse. An impulse knee-jerk reaction to a desire for instant gratification. And it's not always easy to discern the difference between those. You know, is this my intuition talking to me, or is this just an itch I'm trying to scratch? And so for me as a kid, it really felt like the primary adults in my life were people that were leaning more toward impulse rather than intuition. And in fact, I didn't really get a sense that I had much of an example of someone following that quiet intuition. Now, to be clear, that might not actually be true. Perhaps these adults in my life were following that quiet voice. It's just that when they were following that voice and then having to deal with their own kind of cost-benefit analysis when running their internal risk calculations, the experience I had at that, you know, I was exposed to as a result of those decisions were uncomfortable much of the time, and I didn't like it. So it's almost like, you know, thinking about my parents making their decisions, the experiences they were having may have been such that when they ran that cost-benefit analysis internally, the benefits outweighed the cost. But for me as a kid, the experiences I was having in by proxy felt like it was not working in my favor. And so what I learned through those experiences was to be very, very suspicious of any decisions that didn't feel like that I couldn't rationalize. I couldn't use concrete data to sort of provide a defense for. And that led to some really interesting conundrums. So another sort of element going on at play inside of me. I am a highly sensitive person. And just as a really quick refresher here, high sensitivity is not, you know, oh, I'm a ninny, although I'm that too. But it's more about how we respond to our environment. So very briefly, you know, Elaine Aron puts it into these four categories: depth of processing. So we think about things very deeply. We make a lot of connections. We integrate a lot of information. We're easily riled to enthusiasm, which is lovely because it's very difficult for us to get bored. But the downside is it's also very easy for us to get overwhelmed by a lot of stimulus in our environment. And we are emotionally granular. So there's a lot of attention that's getting paid to our internal emotional weather. And then sensory sensitivity. So our senses are picking up on a lot of data in our environment. Now, I want to be clear here, this does not mean that we're a bunch of, you know, Sherlock Holmes cruising around and deducing all kinds of things. Sometimes we can be painfully oblivious to what's right in front of our faces. But we're looking at this sort of nitty-gritty details. We're looking between the lines of what we see quite frequently, which means there's a ton of information that we're trying to integrate, which is part of why we get overwhelmed more easily. So just as a quick refresher there. I am also, though, someone who loves novelty. So I'm someone who you would classify as being a sensation seeker. I enjoy traveling to new places, growing, having new experiences, having new conversations, challenging myself. So I, in my own self, have these two warring kind of, pulls that are happening. One toward tranquility and contentment, and the other toward novelty and excitement. So that makes things challenging all on their own. Now, what's interesting about that for me is, especially as I'm thinking about my culture, the culture we live in, or at least in my case, I'm in the United States, and I think so Canada would probably be very similar. There's a number of countries in Europe. So westernized culture celebrates that part of me that seeks out novelty and growth, that ambitious part of me, the one sort of howling at the moon. That part of me is celebrated and is sort of held up as a champion. And so what would happen in my calculations and in my decision-making processes is I would perpetually move toward that part of me that wanted more, more novelty, more intrigue, more travel, more ambition, etc. Which is lovely because it's not as though my movement in that direction was a lie. I wasn't not being my true self. I was just not being my whole self, because this other half of me, this part of me that needs rest to recharge so that my brain can do what it needs to do and actually integrate all of this, you know, novelty and growth that I'm seeking, I was ignoring that. That part of me that needed quiet and tranquility and sort of softer landscapes, I was ignoring that, because those aren't aspects that are celebrated by my culture. I wouldn't say that there's a ton of animosity toward them. They're just not really given any license or they're not held up as an exemplar of what it is to be a success in our culture. And so anytime that intuitive voice inside of me would be yearning for something that was outside of what the culture was celebrating, I would ignore it. So what would kind of happen is I'd end up in these situations where I'd bite off more than I could chew. I'd go deep into people-pleasing mode and into ambition mode. And something inside of me would whisper, like, you need to do something different. This isn't working for you anymore. You can't keep doing this. And because I didn't have an example, or at least I didn't perceive that I had examples of people who were very thoughtful about weighing that internal voice alongside all the other elements at play in their lives, and instead just impulsively went with whatever they thought they wanted, I was very suspicious of that voice, that tug inside of me. And so it would almost be like I'd go through these five stages of grief. Like, as an example, if I had overworked myself when I was getting double major in college and I was working and I was trying to keep a relationship thriving and all the things, something inside of me was saying, you need to do something different. You need to stop. You need to rest. And I did not want to do that, because doing that would have meant sort of a retreat away from that part of myself that I was infatuated with. So it's almost like I'd go through the classic stages of grief, like denial. Like, no, I don't really need to leave this job or leave this environment or leave this relationship. And then anger. I'd be so, what is wrong with me that I can't hack this? This is making me so angry. I don't want to need rest. I don't want to need to leave this relationship or this job. I don't want it. I don't want it. I don't want it. And then bargaining. Well, okay, maybe I do need to get out of this relationship. But what if instead I didn't do that and I just spent more time to myself? So still connected in that relationship, but just more weekends better to myself. So would that be enough? Or if in the case of a job that I needed to leave, okay, so what if I don't leave that job and instead I just take the hours that I'm working in it and turn it down? Or, well, I don't really want to leave that job, but what if instead I just take on a second job and that second job can be the thing that feeds me in the ways I need to be fed, and then this primary job can just pay my bills? What if I do that? And obviously that wouldn't work, and eventually that would lead to burnout and depression, because burnout and depression are basically cousins. There's a lot of distinctions between them, but that burnout experience where I have a sense of apathy, a sense of, you know, the world is a dark, dark place and no one cares, a sense like a loss of power, a sense that I don't have any agency and influence in my environment, so why bother trying? And then, of course, just that pure, unadulterated exhaustion. So I'd be crying every night on the bathroom floor. Side note, how weird is it that every single author person I know that is inspiring who talks about depression and burnout often ends up like on the bathroom floor crying? I think that's weird. Something about bathrooms. Anyway, and then finally, there would be acceptance. And I would just accept that that voice that had started off as a quiet whisper and had now become a very, very loud yell was maybe not full of bullcaca and in fact had some wisdom to offer me. And maybe, just maybe, I should try and listen. Maybe even behave in alignment with it. I mean, I don't know that I actually entertained the idea that it was right. It was more that I had exhausted all the other options. So fine, I'll accept it. And then, like clockwork, things would improve. Now, when I say things, I don't necessarily mean my external environment. So I left jobs before and didn't have a backup plan. And I did not just immediately end up wealthy in a better paying job. Sometimes I ended up really down to the wire or having to hustle hard doing, you know, a number of odd jobs to pay the bills. But my experience of myself would improve. So it was very, very interesting. And I've watched myself dance with this voice, voice of intuition, whatever you want to call that thing. And what I'm starting to see happen is that the gap between when the voice first comes online and whispers that something needs to change, and the point when I actually make the change the voice is alluding to, is getting smaller and smaller. So whereas it used to take several years and me on the floor in tears, three nights in a row of no solid sleep, now it went from years to maybe only 1 year. And then from 1 year, maybe to a few months. And most recently, I've made the decision. So I was working in a great job. So I want to be very clear about this. The place that I was working in, they were not mean to me. They were sensational. It was not a boring job. It was a very good job. It was not a toxic work environment. It was a lovely physical space. It was emotionally safe. There really was no good reason to leave, except that this little voice was coming on and had been whispering for a little while, that kept pulling me in the direction of being my own, sort of being a solopreneur, of being a coach. And the reasoning behind this was just, like, I didn't have any rational kind of, well, research shows that those who become solopreneurs make more money. Like, no. But there was just this yearning, a yearning to lean into, you know, as a sensitive person, to take all the things that I had learned about how to create a life that didn't have to result in burnout and misery and depression and didn't have to result in isolation and loneliness and being an outcast. I wanted to take that and help others because basically I wanted to be the kind of advocate for other sensitive people that I really wish I had found in my past when I was desperate and alone and confused and didn't understand why my system was dysregulated the way it was. And that became something that was so powerful, a force, a desire, a yearning, that I couldn't ignore it. And the job that I was in was making it very difficult to be able to do that job while also holding a private practice as a certified coach, wellness coach, burnout coach, etc. The first thing I tried is, you know, first I denied it. Like, no, I can't leave. That's insane. Then, of course, I got angry at myself. Like, what's wrong with me that I can't just be happy where I am? And then there was bargaining. So went in and it's like, I don't want to leave this amazing job. So what if I just turn my hours back down to 30 hours, which would have been fine, except that the position I was in needed me to be really nimble. So this was not a typical like come to work for from the hours of 10 a.m. to 3 p.m. or whatever. It was, okay, today you're going to come during these hours, and then the next day during these hours, and then the next day you're going to come in the morning to do a screening event, and then the next day you'll stay in the evening to teach a class. And then this coming week you'll need to work on a Saturday, but then you'll just have to flex your hours from the week before. And all of that's fine. None of that is unreasonable because it was a salaried position and the work I was doing was rewarding. It just makes it very difficult to have a private practice and have steady hours that my clients could rely on while trying to juggle that alongside a position where I honestly did not know what hours I would be called upon to put forth. And this was maybe the first time in my life that I started the conversation with my supervisor, my job, before I was in burnout mode, before I was desperate. I was just honest. Like, hey, here's what's happening for me. I'm seeing things pick up in a good way in my private practice, and I'm seeing things pick up here at the hospital. And I'm starting to see that I, because of the needs of the facility, I'm becoming a liability because my availability is coming down right at the point when you need it to be up. What are your thoughts about this? What are our options? And that conversation led me to be positioned out of a benefited, solid position into a contract role where I would get, you know, a handful of billable hours perhaps, but no benefits. And now I'm free to go about my business and be a private contractor, a solopreneur. Woo! I mean, exciting. It's sort of like Charles Dickens, you know, it was the best of times, it was the worst of times, it was the age of wisdom, it was the age of foolishness. So this is all to say, like, this is the risk that I'm taking right now. Hence why I'm interested in talking about it. And I guess the good place to start in terms of what, you know, information to cover here is, well, what is a risk exactly? So definition, there's of course risk as a noun and then risk as a verb. As a noun, it's just a situation involving danger. If it's a verb, it's to expose someone or something valuable to danger, harm, or loss. So in my case, like, the risk that I'm taking is I'm exposing myself to danger, danger of not making enough money, danger of, well, putting myself out there and being rejected, of being considered a fool, and, well, danger of losing all of my financial stability. I mean, those things are not pleasant. And so in terms of trying to navigate this thing, there's a lot that goes into it. So I've of course, am listening to podcasts and I'm reading books from people who are saying, just do it. You can do it. And, you know, they put down the systems of, if you just are consistent in your marketing protocols and you network consistently and you put all the things. I'm listening to all of that. But what's challenging is, on the flip side of what's happening, just like that part of there I've mentioned before, there is part of me that is just was yearning for this novelty and this new way of navigating the world. So I'm following my knowing, but there is still this other half of my brain that does not like risk. And it's really interesting as it relates to highly sensitive people. The brain is actually highly affected by a number of elements at play in its in our environment. So as one example, we don't respond to dopamine and we don't seem to respond to dopamine in the same way as most people, which, you know, it's not entirely understood what the mechanisms are that are making it different, but how it's manifesting, because dopamine is that chemical inside of us that gets lit up when we scratch an itch. It's that when you tick something off on your to-do list, you get a little doo-doo dopamine hit. When you get a text message alert, doo-doo-doo, that's a dopamine hit. When you're at the casino and you push a button and you win $0.25, $25, whatever, dopamine hit, when you eat sugar, when you have alcohol, you name it. These are all pleasure, sort of like the external reward centers that get lit up. But with sensitive brains, they don't appear to be as drawn or taken in by the promise of an external reward, which I think, so in my case then, the idea of having all of my metrics as it relates to my business being tied to anything external or rational, which, as I've mentioned earlier in this episode, I have been leaning on a lot in my life because I needed that validation externally to prove my intuition was correct. I've had to do a lot of growth in that area, but for much of my life, I've had to kind of like, oh, I have the intuitive sense, but I wouldn't make a move on it until I could prove with something tangible, some tangible data, that it would be the right decision. And so that's one element at play. Another element at play is that our brains, sensitive brains, appear to be extremely attuned to the emotional or our perception of emotions of people around us. So when shown images of sad people, of people we think are sad, or people that are happy, our brains light up in the areas that are responsible for planning, for initiating, attention, action planning. So this is part of what I believe leads so many highly sensitive people to be people pleasers. We're constantly scanning our environment, our communities, to take in whether we're being accepted in our community. We do not want rejection. It's very painful. It's painful for everyone, but sensitive brains appear to be even more attuned. That's not to say that we're assessing the emotions of others correctly, merely that when we make an interpretation, we respond pretty drastically to that experience, either joy or sadness, what have you. So this puts sensitive people in a bit of a conundrum, especially when you're living in the United States. Because here's the thing. What our culture celebrates is the hustle. Our culture celebrates external rewards. Our culture celebrates, like, go buy a big house, make a lot of money, find your person, and ride off into the sunset with your romantic partner and live happily ever after with 2.5 kids. And if at all possible, a fence that gently wraps around your little, universe. And that's not something that draws out a highly sensitive person in the same way. I don't mean like, oh, we're just not selfish, like materialistic, like the rest of you. I just mean the brain isn't wired to get excited about the prospect of, oh, I bought a new house, I got more money, I got more. We are still going to appreciate, though, the validation that we get from other people when we make those, when we meet those metrics, we cross the threshold of all of that. Like, if that's championed, we absolutely want acceptance. And that too is a kind of external reward. It's just a little bit, it's different. So if you're living in a culture that celebrates something that your brain doesn't actually jive with, well, now there's no way you can move without taking a risk. You either risk your own sense of self, like your contentment, your joy, your sense of being in alignment with who you are. So you risk burnout, desperately chasing after what your culture tells you should acquire. You're risking depression because there's this mismatch between who you are and who others want you to be. You're risking your health and your vitality because you're exhausted. You're not getting enough sleep. You're constantly producing because the world around you tells you need to be always producing. So you're risking a lot by just blindly following what the culture tells you to do. But if, on the other hand, you do follow that internal voice, that knowing, that sense of, no, I know who I am, I know why I'm here, and I'm going to follow it, and it does not align with the culture, well, now you're risking rejection. And this is why highly sensitive people, particularly those who end up in, leadership positions or managerial positions, or who seek out entrepreneurship, end up in a bit of a tug of war. They get the sense that I have to make a decision. I can either go off into the wilderness by myself and have ease and tranquility and contentment, or I can be fully immersed in my community and in my culture, but I will have to sacrifice who I am and only sort of do what I'm told. I will have connection, but yet I won't. So either way is a risk for so many sensitive people. It's kind of heartbreaking. And what I think is, you know, it's actually kind of interesting. There are a number of folks who have said that, you know, many of us know about this, the pyramid in terms of hierarchy of needs. I believe it was Maslow who crafted it initially. And in that pyramid, what he articulates is, you know, humans have, in order for humans to become their, meet their best potential, they need to have these needs met, and in more or less this order. So first they need to have a sense of safety. And then from there, if they feel safe, then they can go into if they have their baseline needs, food, shelter, and so on. Well, then the next one is, do I feel secure? And then the one after that is, do I feel like I have a sense of belonging? And then from there, it's okay, well, now am I intellectually being satisfied? And then from there, am I aesthetically satisfied? And are my surroundings beautiful? And then from there, there's this self-actualization thing. And then from self-actualization is transcendence. You can look this up. I'm not going to go into a ton of detail around it, but there's a hypothesis that for highly sensitive people, it's inverted. So for them, they first need to feel like they have a sense of transcendence, a connection to that which is bigger than themselves. Then they can self-actualize. So it's, I want to feel connected to that which is beyond my understanding. Then I want to figure out who I am in the context of that. From there, then I want to come down and have, you know, the intellectual or the aesthetics, I want to create a world of beauty, and then cognitive understanding of that beautiful thing I created, and then relationships, and then material needs being met. So if that's true, I don't know if it is, I don't have any proof, but if it's true, holy moly, no wonder sensitive people feel like so discombobulated all the time. Yikes. So then the question becomes not so much how do we avoid risk, although as I've, you know, one thing I can say about sensitive brains, we really, really don't like risk. This comes up in hundreds of species. Sensitive beings, antelope, fish, etc., will pause and reflect before just leaping into something new because they don't want to expose themselves to unnecessary risk. They are sensitive to that. So then what we end up with is having to make a decision about what kind of risk we want to take. Do we follow the culture and risk our health, or do we follow what works for us and risk excommunication and rejection? Ouch. So for me, I had to figure out this because over and over, I kept going with cultural expectations and risking my health and my vitality because the idea of being rejected and excommunicated and belittled, or having my financial health called into question, was more terrifying than my health and vitality being disrupted. I was willing to lose sleep over it for survival, sure. And then over time, that started to flip, where my willingness to sacrifice my health and my contentment is getting lower and lower. So then that leads me to kind of talk about, well, what is it that's driving that shift, that change? How do we create lives that allow us to have tranquility and contentment and still feel connected to our communities and have a sense of esteem in our society? Is it possible that we don't have to choose? Is it possible that we can create something that gives us access to both? And I think the answer, at least in my experience, I'm starting to experience that the answer is yes, we can have both. Well, then that brings us to, how? Like, how do we have both a sense of esteem in our communities, a sense of feeling right where we are where we need to be, people celebrating us in our community, even if the culture is a little bit different than, you know, that the classic culture is saying something different than that which we feel is right. How do we still feel plugged into our community and feel like we are a part of that landscape, while also following our true selves, our own needs? Well, the first thing seems to be that we need to get really, really clear on what it is that we are so afraid to expose to loss. In my case, I was afraid of rejection and I was afraid of destitution. I did not want to go broke and I did not want to be... it's not that I didn't like alone time. I'm very introverted. I like having time to myself. But I also really love love. I love being connected to other people. Even if a smaller circle, it makes me feel better than a large one. So for me, that was the loss that I had to risk. Okay, so once I was really clear on that, which I was terrified of losing, and for each person, it might be different. For you, perhaps you're yearning to go and start your own business, but you're terrified of the risk that you would expose to your family. You have children to feed, you know, college funds to continue to fund into, or I don't know. Or maybe you're yearning to sell your house and live in a tiny home in the middle of nowhere, but you're really afraid that in fact you can't do it. And that if you were to do that, maybe you'd be all by yourself and totally alone. And maybe that wouldn't even ultimately fix the issue that you're contending with. And you're thinking, what if I do all of that and it doesn't make a difference? And I'm still exhausted and I still feel disconnected. Then what? Okay, so that then brings you to the next line of inquiry, which instead of, you know, a really common coaching question that's asked all the time is this one. They'll say, what would you do if you knew you couldn't fail? And I appreciate what the question is trying to achieve. It's trying to remove the fear element and just talk about desire. It's trying to say to you, what if I could promise you that if you sold your house and moved into a tiny home in the middle of nowhere, that you would be able to hack it and that it would be a success? Would you want to do it? What if I could promise you that you would not be rejected and that if you went and decided to become a solopreneur, you would make way more money and have way more ease and more time than you ever had as an employee? What if I promised you that? Would you go for it then? So it's like, and if the answer is no, like, oh, actually, maybe not, because I'd still be by myself and I kind of like when people are telling me what to do, because then I can kind of just ease in. I know what the expectations are. I don't have to be the constant, like, the driver of my own engine. You know, I don't think I actually, when you get down to brass tacks, even if I knew everything would be fine, maybe I just don't want it badly enough. Great. Fine. Now you know. But here's the problem with that question. The question that is, what would you do if you knew you couldn't fail? It's a bullshit question, because there is no set of conditions where you absolutely cannot fail. None. It's a little bit like asking, what would you do if you knew you couldn't die? Like, I suppose it's an interesting philosophical inquiry, but we're all good, sort of, it's like asking, hey, what happened in the movie The Titanic? Well, the boat sunk in the end. We all knew that. Like, we're all our boats are going to sink in the end. We know that. And failure is not something that might possibly happen. It's a damn near inevitability. If you try something new that you don't have an expertise in, you're going to bump around and clumsily fall on your tush once in a while, at the very least. So then, a more interesting question that I like a lot more is, what would you do and what is so important to do that it's still worth doing even if/when you fail? So it's none of this like, if you knew you couldn't fail, what would you do? No. It's like, all right, but what's worth doing even in the worst case scenario? What's worth doing even if you fail? What if you were to be on your butt staring up at the sky thinking, ow, what would it be the thing where if someone walked by you and said, well, was it worth it? You would say, yes, it was totally worth it. And in fact, I'm going to get off my butt here in a minute when I've had a moment to breathe, and I'm going to do it all over again. And this time I'm going to try a little different, but I'm not giving up. If that question can be responded to, and that can be a little bit too big for folks to respond to right away, if you're looking for that thing, a perhaps easier entry point can be something as simple as, what are the problems that you most enjoy solving? And who are the people you most enjoy helping to solve them? That may then lead you into the arena of, okay, well then, what are the things that, what are the problems you most love solving? And would even risk failure to be a part of the solution for. So there's that. It's basically taking failure and it's redefining it as, okay, yeah, it's gonna happen. What's worth doing even when it hurts? And what many people who are fabulously successful and whatever their definition of that is, they have all failed. That's the thing they have in common. They just learned how to fail really, really well. So they see failure not as a problem, but as an opportunity for growth. And we'll talk about growth in a little bit, but it's not seen as the enemy. It's seen as an ally. I'm going to do this thing and I'm going to fall on my butt and it's going to hurt real bad. And then I'm going to get back up. I'm going to do it again. So if you're trying to get into that headspace of this is what I really want to do, I'm willing to do the hard thing. Okay. But how do we switch gears into that place? One of the people that I think did a really lovely job of kind of crafting a new mindset around this is this idea of, well, it's Elizabeth Gilbert, and she wrote in her book, Big Magic, that there's a difference, but there's two types of energies anytime we consider embarking on something new or consider taking on some risk, whether it's creative risk by writing something, painting something and exposing our art to the world, or whether it's a risk of creating a company, a risk of taking on a leadership role, whatever the risky thing is that you think is worth trying. There's two types of energies that can come online. One is martyr energy, and the other is trickster energy. And this is an excerpt from her book that I just think is so perfect in describing what it takes to build a healthy relationship with risk. So what she says here is, so it's sort of a dialogue between martyr and trickster. Martyr says, I will sacrifice everything to fight this unwinnable war, even if it means being crushed to death under a wheel of torment. Trickster says, okay, you enjoy that. As for me, I'll be over here in this corner running a successful little black market operation on the side of your unwinnable war. Martyr says, life is pain. Trickster says, life is interesting. Martyr says, the system is rigged against all that is good and sacred. Trickster says, there is no system. Everything is good and nothing is sacred. Martyr says, nobody will ever understand me. Trickster says, pick a card, any card. Martyr says, the world can never be solved. Trickster says, maybe not, but it can be gamed. Martyr says, through my torment, the truth shall be revealed. Trickster says, I didn't come here to suffer, pal. Martyr says, death before dishonor. Trickster says, let's make a deal. Martyr always ends up dead in a heap of broken glory while Trickster trots off to enjoy another day. Martyr equals Sir Thomas More. Trickster equals Bugs Bunny. I love this excerpt. This is, again, Elizabeth Gilbert. Is what she's getting at here is what it takes to create a life that looks like you and that doesn't cause unnecessary suffering. What it would take for a highly sensitive person to lean into their aspirations, their goals, their visions, is taking on the identity of an artist. You're a creative person now. You're going to create a life. And instead of imagining that the world is finite and that you only get to have belonging or a sense of self, a connection with self, it's instead saying, no, I'm going to take I'm going to cherry pick all of the things that are important to me in my life. And I'm going to create a life that allows me to have all of it. And I'm going to make a hot mess while I make this attempt. It's that trickster energy. And what's interesting about trickster energy is you keep seeing this in some of the wisest characters in fiction. So Trickster isn't just Bugs Bunny. Trickster is Rafiki in The Lion King. Rafiki was very wise, considered the, sort of the equivalent of a shaman or the medicine man. Trickster was Genie in Aladdin. Trickster was Yoda in Star Wars. Trickster is Don Juan in Journey to Itlan. Trickster continues to be the temperament of someone who gets that things are complex, nuanced, interesting. And so if you can take on the trickster creative vibe and say, this is going to be fun. And every time you hit a bump, go, well, that was interesting. Every time something goes wrong, you can think, well, that was unexpected. And instead of thinking of it as, oh, everything's going to hell in a handbasket, instead it's more of a, well, everything is changing because that's the world being a world. Imagine what life could be like if we could let go of this idea that it has to look the way we thought it needed to look. Imagine if we could take on the spirit of an artist who just gets in there and gets his hands dirty and doesn't really care so much if it ends up looking beautiful at the end because it was the process that was so lovely. It's also, by the way, the spirit of what yogis consider to be sort of the journey toward self-actualization. They talk about these three things that you want to engage in, and I bring this up a lot. It's do the work, watch yourself, and to the best of your ability, let go of the outcome. The journey is toward independence. And not, by the way, independence as in you must go your own way and there will be no one and nobody to help you. But it's independence from patterning. Independence from limited thinking. A sense not that it will be okay, but that I will be okay. I'm going to go after this thing. I'm going to give it a shot. And no matter what happens, I will figure it out. I will deal with it. And maybe the thing I thought I wanted won't come to pass. Maybe it won't come to fruition. But I will have learned something valuable, and it will at the very least inform my next step, the next right thing that I need to do. So then, with that in mind, the next question becomes, well, how do I take the appropriate amount of risk? Because as a sensitive person, you know, some people have a very high tolerance for risk. They're thrill seekers. So some people, in other words, are sensation seekers, but are not sensitive at exactly the same time and in exactly the same measure. So then, what's an amount of risk that we can engage in that will help us to grow without destroying us? So another way of thinking of this that I like to use a lot is, you know, imagining when you go to the gym to work out. Well, you want to feel a certain measure of that burning sensation of pain. You're willing to kind of bumble around a little bit, but you don't want to like injure yourself. If you go to the gym every day and you do a lot of strength training and you keep breaking down muscles, because that's what you do when you're doing strength training. You're breaking your muscles down so that they can rebuild a little bit stronger. That's the benefit of failure too. Every time you fail at something, you break some ideas, some assumptions down, and then you can rebuild a little bit stronger. You build more resiliency, more tolerance for this risk stuff. But you don't want to go too far too fast. You do that and you'll get seriously injured. And then you're going to have to spend weeks trying to nurse yourself back to health. There's a framework that's used around this. And that's this idea of there's a comfort zone, there's a stretch zone, and then there's a panic zone. Most highly sensitive people really, really like their comfort zones for good reason, because that's the place where we feel completely at ease. We feel like we have mastery over our environment. Comfort zone spaces are those places where we are completely at ease, but the only downside is we often might feel boredom, apathy, a sense of ennui. Then there's this next place that's a stretch zone. That's often associated with flow. It's challenging, but it's the right kind of challenge. It's like when you're in a yoga class and you stretch and, oh, you're stretching, and you feel the stretch and, oh, it hurts so good. That's that stretch zone. That's why they call it that. It's when you're doing something that's a little bit out of the familiarity space of your life, but it's not so overwhelming that you feel like you can't pull back at any time, that you don't have a handle on it. So that's the stretch zone. And then there's panic zone. That's where you're doing kind of like the equivalent of a sprint. You're going full throttle into something that really terrifies you. So to give an example, if you were trying to build your capacity for public speaking, Well, how many people can you comfortably talk to right now? Well, two. I can comfortably talk to two people. All right, well, maybe your stretch zone then would be to have those two people invite someone that you don't know so that you're now talking to four people. It's not so outlandish that you can't handle it, but it's a little uncomfortable. The panic zone would be to be immediately thrust into a 30 plus live audience where you're giving a presentation and you don't know them. So the goal then, if you're thinking about taking on a risk, is to take on the appropriate amount at any given time. In my case, there's a reason that I started my private practice probably 6+ years ago and have only gradually begun to build it and get to the place where I'm willing to actually launch fully as a freelance, you know, person who's working on a number of different contracts with a number of different companies, as well as a, private coach who works with sensitive leaders. That risk variable, I had to take it in small doses. I had to take it in small bites, one thing at a time. Now the next thing. Now the next thing. The next element to consider when you're imagining, well, what's the amount of risk that's appropriate for me, is making sure that whatever it is that you engage in, you can easily recover from. So if you're going out to a networking event and that's really scary for you, make sure that you bookend it on both sides such that you have time for recovery, time to sort of charge up for it and time to recover afterward. That's an important piece when you're deciding on the right level of risk. But more than that, you want to create an ecosystem that naturally nourishes you along the way. So much like I mentioned before with that sort of inverted hierarchy of needs, I mentioned that sensitive people tend to feel like they need that sense of transcendence first before they then move down into the more material realms. So then the question for you that you want to make sure and answer is, what is your something larger? What is that thing that you can appeal to when your life is a hot mess and it is outside of the everyday jurisdiction? Maybe it's God, maybe it's nature, maybe it's just simply being in quiet meditation and having conversation with your true self. It could be anything, but you want to feel really connected to that sense of that which is larger. You want to have a sense of meaning and purpose such that, like in my case, when I think about how important it is to me that those who are more sensitive and thoughtful and need more quiet time but aren't given any sort of outlet in the culture that celebrates them in any way that's meaningful, I think of how much pain they're in and how much pain I have been in trying to navigate this world as a more sensitive person. And it just breaks my heart. So I'm willing to be an advocate because I have the capacity, I have the faculties, I have the resources. And I'm willing to do that even if I end up being made a fool, even if it goes to hell, even if it doesn't work, because it's so important to me. And so now every time that I try something and it doesn't work out, that thing that is so important to me though carries me further. I can pick up my pieces and stitch them back together and try again. The next thing you want to make sure that you do is you schedule time for true pleasure. A lot of time, especially in our culture, pleasure is something that we only get to do once we've done the real work. Well, there's a problem with that. Pleasure is what helps fuel our engine so that we can do the real work. We've got it backwards. If you don't take any time for real pleasure, then you won't have the juice you need to do the productive stuff. And when I say pleasure, I don't just mean dopamine-oriented things like the doo-doo-doo that you get from a text message or, you know, from a sugary thing. It's, no, what is that thing that really provides you contentment? Sitting by the fire or going for a hike in nature, sipping a mug of tea, whatever, something that just really nourishes. Pleasure. You want to have your people in your corner. You know, who are people that you can call and or text or whatever when you feel like you're losing your mind? And they will encourage you and say, I know this is really hard, but you picked the right hard. You know, because that's what we're all doing. None of us gets out of having to do hard things. It's just a question of, well, what is the hard I'm going to choose? And you want the people around you, someone that you feel like is your people, to tap you on the shoulder and remind you, no, keep going. I'm right here. I can't protect you, but I won't leave you. I am your ally. I am your champion. You also want to have an outlet to process through some of your hardships. So, you know, interestingly, Julia Cameron, she wrote The Artist's Way. She has a really interesting ritual that she recommends around people who are willing to kind of be creative with their lives. She recommends every morning just taking out a pen and paper and writing for 3 pages. Just write, don't think, stream of consciousness, get all of your gobbledygook on the page, all of your insecurities, all of your ruminations, all of your uncertainty, just put it on the page. And what she argues is if you do that frequently enough, inspiration can come out of those pages. Or at the very least, you're purging the garbage that might otherwise bar you from taking a leap forward. So having some kind of an outlet to process through the hardships that you're navigating is very, very important, especially for a sensitive brain. And then you also want to make sure that you're feeding yourself well. Are you balancing your blood sugar? Are you exposing yourself to nourishing experiences? Or are you spending all of your time watching really bad news? I'm not saying don't be informed. I'm just saying, you know, be intentional about what you expose yourself to so that your capacity is at its highest. And then you also want to have a relationship with this idea of growth. So seeing failure not as something to be afraid of, but as something to embrace in your journey toward growth, and having a growth mindset as opposed to a fixed mindset. So that gets you into that arena of, no, if I fail, it means I'm doing it right because it means that I'm trying. If I fail, it means I'm not good at it, which means I shouldn't be doing this thing. No, if you fail, it's because no, you're not good at it and you're learning to get better. And this thing was necessary for you to learn the lessons you needed to learn and get better next time. In order to do that, you also want to make sure you're exercising your body. So it's great to have an outlet to, you know, write things down. But anytime you're doing something that's inherently risky, and again, that means exposing yourself or something really valuable to you to danger or loss, that's going to get your juices pumping. Highly sensitive systems are very activated all the time. They can easily be sort of led to enthusiasm, but they can also start pumping out adrenaline and cortisol like crazy when stressed. And the only way to leverage or maybe use that adrenaline and cortisol effectively is to move. So you do not want to be solitary. I know for myself, I've had a few days where I've just been almost paralyzed with fear, and I'll grab my keys and I'll just go for a walk just to be able to at least get the buzzing out of my ears so that I can think more clearly. And then finally, rest. You want to make sure that you're prioritizing rest. When you know you're exhausted and yet some part of you thinks that you should feel guilty for not working, don't do that. The thing to remember about highly sensitive systems is that they, I've said this many times before, they operate a lot like cell phones or smartphones rather. They've got tons of functionality. A lot of sensitive people can get done in a very short amount of time what it might take others much longer to achieve. But once they have done that thing, they need to stop. They need to pause. And then they need to recharge. Sort of like the way flip phones, you used to be able to charge them once and last a week. Yeah, but they didn't have the functionality of a smartphone. Smartphones can get you do all kinds of neat things. The fact that sensitive people are creative, adaptable, vigilant, emotionally granular, and intelligent is part of what leads their colleagues, their one-ups, to keep promoting them in the places they work and to keep kind of saying, yeah, you're doing great work, keep going. The problem, though, is that they're then asked to maintain that level of productivity and do it for as long as everyone else is doing it. Oh, great, you can do in 4 hours what it takes your colleague 5, 6, or 8 to do? Well, do that for 8 hours. No. It does not work that way. We need rest. And as I often will allude to the algorithm here, we need 8+ hours of sleep. Well, I'll say 7 to 9 hours of sleep each night, 1 to 2 hours a day of quiet reflection, a full day off every week, a full 6 weeks off every year, not all at the same time, but you know, by the time you've added up all your days and vacation time, it will have allotted to 4 to 6 weeks in total. I mean, dang, that's what you need to thrive? Holy moly. Good luck in the United States. Anyway, though, that's what it's going to take if you really want to go after that, your dream, whatever your dream is. You need to create an ecosystem that's supportive to your endeavors and that's supportive to the way your system functions. So I can tell you right now that what I would love to say is, now let me tell you about how successful, so wildly successful I am. And this is why I can now prove to you that it's important to follow that intuition. But I didn't want to do that. That's way too easy. Lots of books are out there to talk about their success stories. I'm doing this at the beginning. I'm launching this podcast episode when I have no idea. I'm not making a ton of money right now. I have a private practice and I have a non-zero amount of clients, but I've just gone from having one foot in a 30 plus hour a week job, and then what's left over is what I can do for my clients, to now having much more availability, which is lovely, but I'm going to have to build up those spaces and fill that up with voices and people that I'm delighted to work with. It's going to take time. And so I amassed, you know, an amount of savings to support me. I've pieced together a number of other income streams that I can help support myself through it. But I don't actually know if it is going to work out. But what I do know is this. I didn't wait this time around until I was desperate on the bathroom floor crying from burnout and exhaustion from having played tug of war with my intuition for so long. I went ahead and listened a whole lot sooner. And while I can't say for sure that it will work out the way I'd like it to, I can say that my health has improved. I'm not doing as much emotional eating to staunch down the voice of the intuition that's telling me I need to make a change. I'm feeling terrified, but it feels like the right kind of hard, the right kind of scary, the right kind of burn. So I can only tell you that right now, my relationship to myself feels really good. And that, to me, is the primary thing that I'm always looking for when trying to make a decision about whether or not the thing I did was appropriate. So what I will tell you, my dear listener, is if you now are hanging back and going, either maybe I really want to take a risk, but I don't know if I can do it, and you would like some support, please reach out to me. I have availability. Send me an email. You can reach me at leah@thehealthysensitive.com. I can even schedule an appointment. I always do a complimentary deep dive session if you want to do that. And if you just want to join the community, I have an online community. You can just click on, you know, if you go to www.thehealthysensitive.com, there's a community of people that I facilitate. You can get access to workshops that I've led and that I've recorded. You can connect with other people. And if you want none of that and just have a few questions, then send me an email. I would love, love, love to connect with you. Whew. Yeah, I think that's about it. I am very excited. In our next episode, I have a guest speaker. You know, one of the things, out of the stuff that I spoke about today, the primary thing that areas that I think a lot of people sometimes struggle with is, well, yeah, but how do I know what that thing is that I'm willing to risk everything for? How do I know what my sense of purpose is? How do I connect with my sense of dharma? And I will be speaking with Jules DeVito, who is a transpersonal coach and trainer of other coaches. So very excited to be having her, because I feel that she speaks to a number of these topics and issues in a way that is not just robust, but it brings in a whole nother element. So I hope you enjoy her in our next episode as much as I know I thoroughly enjoyed being able to speak with her. Okay, I think that's about it. Housekeeping is done. I hope you have a fabulous day. And again, reach out to me if you ever want to connect. Okay, take care. Bye-bye.